Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Managing Director of Elcut Global Executive Search. Our mission is to connect the supply chain ecosystem globally by bringing forward some of the most interesting leaders and topics in the industry. And very happy to have with us today Alexis Bateman, who is a research scientist at the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics, and also the director of the MIT Sustainable Supply Chains organization. She has over 15 years of experience in sustainability in the public sector, in the industry, as well as in the academic settings. And her work has focused a lot on supply chain sustainability through research, education, and outreach. She has engaged closely with industrial partners, public agencies, global governance organizations, as well as non-government organizations. And also today we are having Sherry Hinnish, who is known as the Supply Chain Queen. Recognized as an IBM Futurist, a 2019 Supply Chain and Demand Chain Executive Pro to Know, and who is among one of the most active and interesting people to follow on LinkedIn, so definitely do that, in the topic of sustainability and supply chain. Sherry is also a strong advocate for sustainable supply chain, for circular economy, and she's, through her sharings and knowledge and case studies, pushing a lot that agenda. So it's my pleasure to have and welcome both Alexis and Sherry to the podcast, and thank you for taking the time.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Super. So let's start. Let's start by quoting a little bit the work of Professor Yossi Sheffi, who I'm sure a lot of our listeners know is the dean of the transportation and logistics side of MIT, and he had come out with a book recently on the sustainability topic, and he was arguing that sustainability is not necessarily a simple case of profits versus planet, but it's a little bit of a more subtle issue of some people versus other people. And what he was mentioning in the book was that those looking for jobs and inexpensive goods are part of our society. And of course, that part of our society obviously are less interested maybe in sustainability, more interested in the price, whereas the other part of our society maybe is looking more at the environment, the future, and making it sustainable. So I guess the first question to kickstart the discussion is how far should we go with sustainability, and also how would you integrate that in the corporate framework, right? Where you have cutting costs, you have reducing risk, and you have obviously achieving growth as criteria for measuring a company.
Great. Yeah. So I'll kick off that one. And having worked with Professor Sheffi for many years now, and I worked together with him on that book, on the Balancing Green book. So it was a great journey to talk to many companies over the years that we researched that book, literally hundreds of different companies and so many different professionals that work across the supply chain in different areas. And I think it became clear along the way, exactly as he phrases in that book, that it was never really, you know, people versus the environment. At the end of the day, everyone is, you know, they have certain needs that they need to meet. They have things that they need in their lives to, you know, feed their kids and, you know, run their daily lives. And it became clear that it wasn't really so much like these evil corporations that a lot of people want to set out and you know, attack, but it was never like that. It's people versus people. And I think learning that perspective really changed how we examine it, because it was, you know, companies inherently are producing a good that someone wants, and that is something that they're going to use, you know, whether it be in a business to business area or a business to consumer scenario, and there's a demand for that. And so it's not them setting out to impact the environment or impact the, you know, social environment negatively. It's really them providing a service or a good to the consumers. And so once we really tried to change the perspective, and Professor Sheffi bringing that perspective, it was easier to look at how things could be changed when you're trying to change the conversation to say, okay, this is, you know, we're working within this context of providing these services and goods for people who are demanding them. How can we shift the perspectives that, you know, it's really, you know, corporations or, you know, these others setting out to impact the environment negatively, when that's never really how it's, you know, that's never the intention. It's really that we're trying to provide a good, and maybe things get impacted along the way. So I think one, starting off and putting out, you know, conversations and talking between players, and we're seeing that, you know, with so many different companies, and, you know, of course, all the big, very public cases of the Unilevers and the Starbucks and the Procter and Gambles that are now, instead of, you know, being very controversial with the, you know, NGOs and other groups that are criticizing their actions, they're instead kind of partnering with some of these groups and partnering with the people that are, you know, looking at them and kind of criticizing how they're operating. And so I think there's a shifting dialogue where it's not this, you know, adversarial scenario anywhere. It's about hearing all the stakeholder voices and hearing, you know, why they, you know, maybe some NGOs, you know, have a certain perspective of how a company is impacting the environment, and they now have brought that informed perspective to the company, and they can weigh that in their decision making and their future strategy. And so I think taking that different perspective has allowed more constructive conversations to say, you know, what are the voices, what are the stakeholders that are being impacted, you know, how can we take into all these different account, you know, and, you know, while it's still far from perfect and there's a long journey to go, that I think that when a company can start to think about those stakeholder voices and then also look into, you know, how this might impact their bottom line, you know, and make it strategic, not just about taking into stakeholder account, but that, you know, and if you can do it in the right way and it becomes an economies of scale issue where many different companies are joining in to this issue of sustainability, whether this be, we're talking about circular economy or, you know, end of life products or getting transparency and traceability upstream, that the more companies do it and the more they adopt those practices, more they adopt the, you know, enabling technologies, that it's going to bring down the costs and it's going to, you know, allow companies to reduce their risk and really, you know, achieve some of the goals of growth the more companies kind of come on to this mission, you know, and that's really my perspective and hoping to, you know, continue that as a perspective that, you know, it's really strategic in the long run.
Super. And Sherry, what would be your view on this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you think about cutting costs, reducing risk, achieving growth, many of the companies that I speak with, they focus on lean improvements, waste management, and some of the business continuity activities that are tied with erratic weather and climate change, you know, retrofitting older buildings and plants, checking the boxes. But you asked us, how far should one go with sustainability? And this is a really provocative question. So let's stir the pot a bit. I don't disagree that sustainability may be a people versus people issue. When you think about human behavior as both the root cause and the solution of many of the crises that we face right now. And the critical question for me is, if stewardship is a duty in corporate sustainability, how far should we go? Or if we take the business as usual approach without regulation or compliance from industry, across trading partners and consumers, how does this impact our planet in 30 years? And I'm probably less pragmatic than other supply chain folks. I'm a mother to 3 small children. I'm a dreamer. And I believe that we unequivocally have a responsibility to do the right thing in the world that we share. And the right things, for example, include decarbonization and social justice. So when you ask, how far should we go, Radu? As far as we need to, that's my answer. What's the price of doing nothing? And you don't have to look very far to see why change is needed. Look at Venice. The massive forest fires in the Amazon, Indonesia, Australia, recent blackouts in Cali, all of these pose a risk to both humanity and in the reliability and viability of supply chains.
Mm. No, for sure. And I mean, even I think where Alexis is in California, there have been some massive fires. And I think this kind of natural disasters are prevalent all over and much more frequent. So we have, there's a need to act as quickly as possible and kind of corroborate all these different perspectives, whether it's corporate, government, social, society, and come together. And I wanted to move it and stir it into a very specific element or industry, which is fast fashion and consumer, let's say, which are the consumer goods, right? Because they are usually some of the most One, they do produce a lot of waste. Two, I know that both of you are very passionate about the subject. So maybe let's start with Sherry and specifically in this segment, fast fashion and maybe FMCG, what would be some of your thoughts in terms of what can be done better to achieve a sustainable supply chain and a more sustainable mindset in general?
Sure. So this is a timely question because the holiday season is upon us. And one of the first things I ask large fashion brands who say that they embrace sustainability is, what are your exact plans to sell less clothing? Black Friday is right around the corner in the States. And I love Patagonia's ad, "Don't buy this jacket." When I think about sustainable fashion, Redu, a few words come to mind: ethical, responsible, radical transparency, circular, and sharing the end-to-end story behind each garment. How are you empowering local communities where you operate? And some of the key challenges when it comes to sustainability are the rising costs of raw materials, ensuring ethical labor that's fair and child-free, and the changing regulatory environments in this transition away from fossil fuels, both in transportation and production. I think some of the most positive changes are the shifts in consumer trends, like the growing segments of Lojas and Naturalites who are supporting slow fashion, and brands like Patagonia, for example. Scale is still a huge challenge in sustainable fashion, and we need to figure out how technology can more efficiently downcycle used garments and how we can collect enough material, because current consumption rates are just not sustainable. From a supply chain perspective, I think we really need to rethink the over-reliance on fresh water end-to-end in fashion. And also this includes the use of cotton and how can we extend the life and wear of garments. So transitioning to business models that include repair, reuse, and creating a conduit for recycling if a garment has reached end of life. I mean, the hard truth is it's really all about personal consumption habits, and we need to change, and that starts with buying less. Folks really underestimate the power of their pocket, in my point of view.
Yeah, I think, really she touched on most of the hot button issues there and how kind of the industry needs to start to act on their environmental and social impacts. I think that was really good kind of coverage. I think some of the issues that come about and some of these consumer focused issues is that, you know, there may be already early movers that are putting out, you know, are doing very kind of innovative things, kind of changing the norm, you know, if we're going to, you know, refer to Patagonia's "Don't Buy This Jacket," right? You know, kind of shifting what we perceive as the norm in the time of Black Friday, where, you know, really there's the increase and advocating for buying more for the holidays and kind of disrupting that. But I think, the evolution over time is going to be slow in terms of consumers being willing to change practices. So I think there needs to be a readiness by the fashion industry to change different models, to offer different solutions, you know, whether that be responsibly sourced, responsibly produced garments, those that are able to be disassembled and taken back so that they can be recycled and create closed loop systems. And then also, you know, trying to shift the mindset for the consumers that, you know, the newest trend is in, you know, buying more continuously is not really, you know, on par with keeping, you know, environmental and social impacts low. So I think there's going to be sort of this, change that needs to happen with the consumer mindset that's not really the best way to go about it. And also looking at different alternatives, whether that being, you know, the desirability of used products, right? So that's another way that Patagonia and other brands and REI and others have kind of offered, you know, these are really good products. There's a lot of life in them. You know, if you want to use it in a secondhand market, you know, this is still appealing. And recently Patagonia opened up the they re-threaded so that you could buy clothes that were made from old clothes. And so I think there's a lot of really interesting things that are going on there. So I think it's promising, but, you know, as Sherry said, the scale and really making this the norm is really far from it. So I think that, you know, with these kind of early movers, with these innovators and different options beginning to be out there and having that be a desirable, you know, thing for consumers will make it easier for the industry as a whole to shift. But, you know, as far as, you know, the way that businesses and supply chains are designed is to, you know, push more to produce more. So I think that it's going to have to be a fundamental shift in a mindset, in a consumer perspective, in the industry to really shift to those practices. But you know, there are some promising innovations out there and different practices that I think are leading the way. And if we can make that more the norm, then it's going to be, you know, there's going to be a lot of promising change.
Right on.
I can share that in this part of the world, for example, Alibaba, and is not so well known, and I don't think they've made a lot of noise about it, and they should, but they have a massive program of collection and then a redistribution of secondhand clothes. So they, I haven't looked into the whole detail, so I don't know if they actually recycle it and make, I mean, I think partly they use the clothes and make new ones from the old clothes, and partly is sanitizing them and then reselling it as secondhand clothes. But that's a massively growing business for Alibaba in this part of the world. And obviously also in Asia, depending on the country, there's emerging economies, there's different buying power in terms of different countries. So that can work better maybe here, but it's still something that is highly successful for them. And I want to jump a little bit because the root cause of this discussion is maybe, I mean, the system in itself, right? So we are, most countries operate on most of the world actually on a very capitalistic model where, you know, you sell more, you make more money, then you're happier or you're contented or your value of the company grows, right? So that's the model. So basically companies in general, in order for them to change, given that the overarching model is, you know, sell more, make more money, is hard. And it almost starts, or the question that pops into my head is also, what are some of the mindsets that, and how to operate on the mindset of the consumer, right? Because if a consumer keeps having, and we are all consumers, right? You, me, everybody keeps thinking that we need to change our clothes and faster and have diversity and all of that, then we're kind of fueling this industry, and the industry is just going to continue to give us the same thing. So I guess the other flip coin or flip side is there, what more can we do on the mindset of the consumer side so that consumers through their behavior start also pushing the industry or fastening the change in the industry?
Yeah, I mean, I can share a point of view. I think that it's complicated. And the reality is that many consumers lack insights and awareness of, you know, the shared benefits of purchasing sustainable products. And it's really hard to visualize accountability for everyday purchases. So education and awareness are a key pathway, I think, in transitioning consumer behavior and transitioning toward a sustainable world. And when people, family members, friends, they say, you know, what advice can you give me? The number one piece of advice is consume less, waste less, and don't make excuses. You know, sustainability, it can no longer be the conspiracy of silence, meaning we have an arrogance and an ignorance around climate related issues. It needs to be a part of dinner table conversation. And we also need to embrace the opportunity to share this information, just like this podcast, share across social media, learn across digital platforms. And the key is really act and just start. Don't wait, because we don't have time. Climate change is a critical issue. Life expectancy is declining. We're seeing the greatest income inequities since the 1920s, and we have an opportunity to act right now. So talk to your children, your family, your friends, and really focus on, you know, one day, one step at a time. How can I consume less and waste less?
Yeah, I like every part of that answer. Definitely think all of that is very relevant. I think the other part of it is making the kind of definitions and accessibility to what is sustainable, you know, more common language to those that are, how is this going to impact the environment? How it's going to impact my life and my children's futures? And, you know, when I even, you know, at the, as you've kind of brought up, like the dinner table, right, thinking about what is sustainability on what are supply chains, I couldn't even tell you that even sometimes my own family could define those two pieces, right, because they are complex and they're deep. And so the easy, you know, engagement practices in terms of, you know, as Sherry said, you know, consuming less, wasting less, those are, you know, the easy kind of practical lessons. But, you know, trying to think of the ways that you can do that in your immediate life, with which, you know, we have these, you know, this environment that consumption is advocated for, you know, that it's going to be a transition over time. So how can we provide consumers tools, you know, to buy the right products that are going to last them for a long time, they're going to enable them to do those different things, and to what end, and, you know, why they're doing it, right? Because I think there is really a pretty deep-seated, you know, mindset that, you know, buying more and buying these products is, you know, it makes me feel good, and it makes me, you know, it serves a need, you know. And so I think that the way that we can kind of offer opportunities to transition, inform transition, so that this is something that is, you know, they know, and it's clear that this will be, you know, for the betterment of the world and betterment of their families. So I think there's going to have to be a transitionary period where that information becomes kind of digestible to the lay consumer, so that they can make those informed choices. You know, we do at CTL, we do different kinds of research in terms of, you know, to what extent that consumers really kind of understand some of the choices they're making, you know, when they're at point of sale, and whether, you know, labels that, you know, tell them this is a more sustainable product, you know, whether that will change their buying habit at point of sale. And, you know, unfortunately, we're not seeing a lot of, you know, promising moves there. But, you know, I think that the more that they have the opportunities to make those choices, and the more that they are choices that are held equal in terms of, you know, price and quality, then they will make those choices. It's just that, you know, there's still kind of a limited opportunity for them to make those choices where they don't necessarily have to pay more, or it's not perceived as poor quality. So I think we're getting there. So I think that the consumer component needs to be top of mind. But I think the other part of it is that companies can't just act for the consumer. There's so many different reasons to act for the, you know, their kind of, you know, their future as a company, for the communities they're impacting, for the various stakeholders that are looking to it. So it has to be kind of a comprehensive response of why they're not doing it, not necessarily just for the consumer. So just kind of thinking about, you know, both from the consumer and for the company action perspective.
And yeah, I was going to say,
Alexis, you bring up a great point that it's easier to have blinders on, and it's easier to just be lazy and do nothing and throw it over the wall. But the insights that you mentioned, so people can understand the impacts of consumption and decision making. And, you know, when you mentioned the company's responsibility and understanding total cost of ownership, so that also means considering a wider range of environmental, social, and economic issues. And I don't know that people are really, at least in my experience, when you think about CSR, I don't think that it's as mature as it needs to be at this stage.
Right, absolutely not.
And on the topic of maybe sharing some other case studies, because you've mentioned, both of you, you've mentioned Patagonia, and it's a great example. And I think they've almost, I mean, the whole brand of Patagonia stands for sustainable clothing and fashion and all of that. But maybe we can also look at other industries, other companies that you've seen doing some good things. You know, I would even challenge you if you can think of, and maybe Alexis, you look at a lot of your clients at MIT and the corpus that you work with. Maybe even taking decisions that on the short run may impact their bottom line and may not be profitable, but on the long term would either get value from financials, but also maybe from prestige, from obviously from brand, for from doing the good right thing for the right for the right cause, for the right environment. So maybe you can share some other case studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I have a couple that come into mind, and, you know, there's too many to list, right? We could go on forever on the companies that are doing really innovative things, but you know, one company that I like to work, or that I've worked with over the years and is doing really some interesting things is Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps. So they're based in Vista, California, and they have home goods and you know, body soaps and cleaning products. And so they have been around. They're a family company, and they really, as we were doing the research across many companies, and you know, Yossi and I came upon them years ago with our colleague Edgar Blanco, and they just did things that kind of buck traditional supply chain trends, right? So when they were going to put together their formula of soaps, they determined that palm oil was necessary. They couldn't really replace that ingredient. And as we know, palm oil is, you know, it's an ingredient that's has environmental impacts in terms of deforestation around the world, primarily in Malaysia and Indonesia, and impacting the smallholder farmers that grow it. And so they really, you know, wanted to understand where their palm oil was coming from. So they actually just, instead of trying to go into the nebulous kind of commodity market to source that material, they vertically integrated a mill so that they could ensure that they were sourcing from different smallholder farmers that were being paid fairly, that were not grown on deforested land, they had full visibility. And so, you know, something like a vertical integration, you know, granted they're a small company and they can operate a little bit differently, but they are, you know, they're, as companies, they're looking for growth, you know, they want to kind of grow their product and their, and you know, show other companies that they can operate this way and still make a profit. And so they pay that up for an investment so that they could ensure that they had a, you know, as sustainably grown as possible. You know, of course, defining sustainability for something like palm oil is kind of a circular thing, but it's very hard, and it's still, you know, there's no agreed upon definition, but you know, the best that they could do, right? Really, truly the best. They know that they can look into their supply chain, have that full visibility to farm level, know what's happening. You know, they do pre-seeding of funds so that, you know, the farmers aren't impacted, whether it depends on if they have a, you know, very productive year or not productive year, so that they can have that money in advance. You know, they just do things that are against the norm, but they still continue to grow. You know, they've been doing post-consumer recycled plastic for years when, you know, I think that some companies are just starting to learn how to do that and really kind of starting from scratch, and how are they going to scale that? So they're one that I've looked to that, you know, they just do the opposite of what everyone else does, and it works for them. And I admire their boldness and really kind of disrupting that, you know, in terms of just making sure that they have as sustainable as product. And, you know, the years ago, you know, they even have said, which, you know, is always kind of the crazy example, is they've even turned down buyers to, you know, to retailers that they didn't necessarily agree with, because they felt at the time, and this story is a little bit dated, that they didn't want to sell their product to a retailer that they didn't want to work with. And, you know, if you could think of another case where someone turns down a buyer, you know, I would be hard pressed to find that. So they're one that I'm finding is, you know, they just continue to kind of disrupt the way that it, and they offer a high quality product that continues to grow. And another company that I'm thinking that I'm, you know, kind of very interested in how they're growing and how they're offering is Everlane. So they're a small apparel company out here in the Bay Area, and they're putting the full cost breakdown of their product, which again, very abnormal. Not, you know, not that it shouldn't be the norm, but showing to what extent each node in the supply chain, each partner, each tier, whatever language we want to use, is getting value from the end price that you're paying, right? So that you can see that there's, you know, fair wages being paid to those working at the manufacturing plant, how that values distributed across the supply chain. And I think that that's quite innovative and quite new. And, you know, it seems, you know, I think for how supply chains have operated for many years, that's very disruptive. And I think seeing that they as well, you know, similarly to Dr. Bronner's, are continuing to grow despite, you know, what many companies would say, you know, giving away their secret sauce, right? That they're showing you kind of their whole, you know, the whole cost breakdown of the value that they're getting from that piece of apparel that you're buying. So, you know, I could go on, but I think those are two that I really kind of find doing some very interesting things and, you know, bucking the norms and continuing to grow.
Yet with Everlane, you don't typically see radical transparency end-to-end in a supply chain environment. So
right.
I definitely am a fan of Everlane also.
And also what I've observed, and we had on the podcast Dirk, who's the chief supply chain officer of Henkel, which is a large consumer goods company, and I saw also recently that Colgate managed to create a recyclable tube, and they made that technology freely available. They didn't patent it; they actually made it freely available to the industry. And Dirk from Henkel, to come back to the point, also said that some of the work that they're doing in the space of recyclable packaging, they basically also make it freely available to anybody else. So there is also an increasingly cooperative mindset in terms of companies coming together, sharing the IP, sharing the knowledge, sharing the way of designing more sustainable products, and giving it out for free. Just for, you know, it's for the sake of all of us benefiting, which I think is which is a great thing that is happening, and it's also another shift in the right direction from a change of culture ultimately, right? And the change of corporate culture and corporate mindset.
Just hop in on there. I think that, Colgate making that move is really, a good first move, right? Because this is how we can bring the economies of scale to these innovations, right? Because maybe they are more expensive to start, right? That's always the kind of detractor to implementing right away because it's expensive, right? But then if we have that opportunity to share the IP and bring down the cost for everyone, then these innovations can become more diffuse across entire industries. And Colgate's great for doing that. I also know Seventh Generation in Vermont, they actually were purchased by Unilever a few years back, but they've been doing that for years. So they really, similarly have been a while into doing post-consumer recycled, having, ingredients in their, they did disclosure of ingredients in their cleaning goods, again, against the norm. But in addition to any kind of innovations, they would have sort of a period where they would keep it after release, but then they would open it, so hoping to scale. So it's I would say I'm glad that bigger companies are beginning to do that, because that's how we can really begin to kind of get those economies of scale to bring the cost down.
And shift the needle for sure. And I wanted to specifically, talking in supply chain, we are all supply chain professionals and very passionate about this. How would you say this topic of sustainability at the very macro level is impacting supply chains in general? More specifically, I think all the chief supply chain officers that we've had in the podcast have spoken and have sustainability as a top three, if not top five, focus area for their organizations. So maybe, Alexis, you can share more in terms of how you're seeing things from your interactions with supply chain leaders as well.
Sure. Well, it's a small question, so I can do that in a few words. No, I'm just kidding. So I think in many ways, I mean, I think that, the probably most immediate way that it's in, in practicality is that it's a risk for them, right? Because they're perceiving, whether that be, for weather impacts, or whether that be for, pressure from external stakeholders, whether that be internal from their internal stakeholders, right? That there is pressure to act, whether that be a hard impact on the way their supply chains are operating, whether that be, whether that be a compliance or regulatory requirement that they need to change their practices. So I think that there's pretty significant risk for them to change now. I think that's kind of the no, there needs to be an act. I think there's also a strategic opportunity that there is a way to shift ways supply chains are operating now for the betterment of environmental and social, action, and also have it be, better operating supply chains. So I think there's a significant amount of opportunities. And if we can match that risk with opportunity and see them as one and the same, then, it can be more of a strategic as opposed to like we're a reactionary, where we're doing more of a precautionary to do this for the value of our companies, for the legacy of our companies, and for them to be, companies that are operating in the next 100 years. And I think that, the companies, while, you know, they're not perfect, and, you know, Unilever is probably the clearest one that comes to mind that has been so public about their journey in the space. Again, not perfect, but that they've said, you know, we're shifting the way that we're operating. We're bringing our brands on this. You know, we're going to do this as, you know, our parent brand Unilever, that all our different brands are going to do different components of sustainability within our supply chain to make it sort of a corporate strategic action, so that, you know, our consumers trust us, that we know that we're reducing our environmental and social impact. So I think that there's just really, it's being impacted in so many different ways. And along with the fact that, you know, it's an employee attraction and retention component, you know, not just, you know, it's definitely about the external factors, but I think that, you know, companies that want employees to come and join their company and stay with them, it's really becoming a significant factor. You know, we have our students that come through, and I've been hearing them for years, and I've been working with them for years, and the voice of those that are interested in sustainability gets wider and louder every year, that they want to work for a company that's responsible. They don't want to go home at night and having worked with a company that they feel is not committing in a significant way. So I think that, you know, it's very much outside in, redesigning and revisiting your supply chain practices. It's also within, you know, that they want people that are going to stay with them, that are going to be committed. And if they can't really commit significantly and operate in a certain way, that they're not going to have the right people, they're not going to have the best people. So I think, you know, they're getting hit inside and out, you know, and of course, you know, it's slow, right? I think that it's a transition. So, but I've seen that more in recent years than I've, you know, in the entirety of looking at this topic. So I would probably say the last 3 or 4 years, it's gotten much louder than I've heard in the entire time I've been looking at this topic.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. The whole conversation around value and, you know, creating purpose and vision beyond oneself, it makes sustainability a human issue, and it's not a supply chain issue anymore. It's this global issue in a world we share, and it's much, much deeper than supply chains. And I know that I've gone on the record and I've said that supply chains own the responsibility of product stewardship, but I've changed my mind. And when you think about corporate sustainability, it's not a department. And if a company really has a commitment to sustainability, it's intrinsically a part of every person's purpose. And sustainability should be as much of an individual commitment as a top leader's commitment, in my point of view.
Absolutely. Totally agree. Well said.
Yes. Wanted to also bring into the discussion the piece of technologies that can help in supply chain and can bring a huge impact in terms of sustainability. So, for example, you know, transparency is a big topic. The more transparent your supply chain is, the better it is also to trace a lot of things. So maybe it's linked transparency and traceability, right? So they're two challenges that technology is tackling. And then if you have this, then also sustainability can be achieved easier. So I wanted to ask you both maybe, what are some of the game-changing technologies and the most impactful ones that you think could bring in and lead to more sustainability in supply chain?
Right. So I don't think I can list a few. I think that what makes sense on these is realizing that, you know, any of the solutions are a system of things, right? So it's getting the right information, the right technology, you know, all together and have the right processes in place to make that information actionable. So I think the more that, you know, we're moving from traceability and transparency as sort of a static definition to realizing that it needs to be, you know, the right mix of technologies, the right mix of people, the right mix of platforms and solutions that we can integrate and operate in a certain way and enable, you know, the users and end users of that information to get it in the, you know, quickest and, you know, most digestible format. I think that those are the technologies that are really having an impact because, you know, of course, you know, we want to trace our product. We want to know what's happening upstream, whether we can, you know, slap an RFID on it or however we want to track that and then have that information transmitted and uploaded into shared information platforms and being able to access that, you know, anywhere in the world at any time. I think that those solutions and those that are being integrated in a practical way so that the decision makers have information to that, access to that information. I think those are the ones that are really disrupting it so that, you know, again, making information available to those that, you know, it's actionable information, right? We're at a university, right, that loves to work with data, right? And we got as much data as we can ever want in the world. And we have so much, you know, as we are all talking about big data, right? And we want more information. But at the end of the day, what information do we need to make the decisions that are strategic, that are going to enable, you know, sustainable choices and be more informed about those practices so that we can do better every day? Those are the technologies that I'm seeing the most promising so that we can make informed, and decisions that are strategic. So I think I couldn't, you know, put my finger on, you know, a handful, but, you know, I think that we know that there are some that are disrupting, but really I think it's the systems of solutions that are making it easier for people to act.
So Alexis, I have a question around the shift to net carbon energy. So wind, solar, hydro, biofuel, and, you know, carbon capture and storage. Are you hearing that decarbonization is front of mind for CFCOs, CEOs, COOs?
Am I hearing that it's front of mind? I think it's on everyone's radar, right? If we're going to look at everyone's, you know, materiality assessment and whatever they feel that that's, however we feel they're committed to that mapping of priorities, right? Mm-hmm. And the depth to which their commitment, it's on everyone's radar. As far as sort of the, you know, transition to adopting those energy sources and transitioning to, you know, carbon neutrality, I think that, you know, it's pretty far, right? And I think that the timelines that are out there are much longer than we want them to be, right? They say we're going to be this in, you know, 25 years, and it's just not soon enough. So I think that there are promising shifts in the way that companies are operating and, you know, how they're kind of making different solutions. And of course, you know, their own operations are where they start first, right? Because that's how they have the most control, right? So they say, right, you know, we're gonna, you know, source our energy differently in terms of how we're operating ourselves. But, you know, getting up into the supply chain, those that are not as visible or, you know, operate in different parts of the world and don't really have those opportunities, I think that that's pretty far off. So, you know, it's on the radar, but the adoption, I think, is slow.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, I think too, the investment for renewable infrastructure is lagging. And it's hard for people to imagine the transition right now, current state. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this will definitely take time. But I would want to challenge both of you from a question. Let's say that you are the CEO of, 50,000 people company, manufacturing something. I don't know, let's just put it into manufacturing. But what would be some of the first things that you would do in terms of behaviors and actions that you would try to enforce and maybe low-hanging fruits, right? So that's the first and easiest in terms of the company becoming more sustainable. What would be some of the thoughts that would come to your mind as a CEO?
Yeah, I think a lot of companies have some of these operational efficiencies in place. And these are around lower energy, reducing water use, recycling, everybody bring a coffee mug type of activity. But I think that there are things that you can do that really further the cause. So when it's done right, and I think we've mentioned this a few moments ago, sustainability becomes everyone's mission. And employees can be a great resource for critical improvements. So an example that I can share from my own work, encouraging rethinking day in the life processes and behavior. So how might we do this differently, considering total cost of ownership and environmental impacts? This could be a life cycle analysis mindset. It could be a mindset of minimizing consumption or thinking about waste as a resource, more like collaborative consumption and network-based stewardship. And I remember Dr. Kevin Lyons at Rutgers, one of the first sustainability classes I took 3 years ago, saying that he was a supply chain archaeologist. And, you know, when I asked him in my early journey, what can I do? Where are the low-hanging fruit? He said, always start with waste. Literally, observing trash and services and waste that is all around you. So one of the activities that's worked in the past is holding green hackathons. You're incentivizing and gamifying engagement in a way that's really cool, and it gets folks excited about sustainability. And you can rally around purpose and create camaraderie amongst employees and even bridge workforce generations. Another thing is reducing travel and using digital workplace or remote work. You can lower your carbon footprint and also decrease operational overhead. It gives folks more time back. And we've seen recent success stories from Microsoft recently and others reducing the work week and increasing productivity. And I've actually worked in a 3-2 schedule and had shared workspaces. I've recently worked remote. It's great. And I think, just lastly, the reality is that you depend on your supply chain for integrity across partners and trading relationships that really extend beyond your immediate purview. So a great way to embrace sustainability is support other businesses with a commitment to sustainable ways of working. These are all great steps.
Yeah, I agree with every single one of those. I think that definitely starting within your own organization to get the adoption. You know, I've looked at organizational change for sustainability, how different companies have done it, and it's always a mix of different solutions and many of those that Sherry mentioned in terms of how we get employees to adopt it in their own daily practices, right? So if they embed it with how they live at home, with how they're working in their office, with how they, you know, operate in their daily life, that reusable mugs and plates and using public transit and, you know, the opportunities afforded that can really, you know, do that on their own personal footprint. And then once that's sort of embedded in their own persona and their own daily life, then that can transition into their daily jobs. And then how, you know, there are responsibilities allotted to everyone to be making sustainability a part of their, you know, their yearly report and their annual review, and making, you know, the ownership diffuse across different employees as opposed to a singular sustainability department, and making it everyone's roles and in one way or another, and, you know, making it a challenge and an opportunity, and having those, you know, communications that are praising those and praising the small wins. And, there's a lot of critics about small wins and, you know, we're not moving enough needle. And while I know that to be true as well, I think that the small wins are where we get started, right? That they're saying, even yes, if it's, you know, we turned off the lights, we saved a certain amount of energy, we reduced water this month, you know, and every step counts, and they build in, you know, and of course sharing that broadly so that others can adopt those small wins, so that that small win across many, many different companies, many different organizational units, that becomes a big win. And I think that's the only way we can get started. So I think that kind of really those low-hanging fruit within your own company. And, there's also knowing that no transition is easy. So if you can get those small wins to begin with, and when you want to tackle the big wins, and knowing that it's not going to be a linear journey from, you know, getting your supply chain to come along with you on this journey, you know, whether that be your direct suppliers or trying to get engagement deeper in the supply chain, or even looking at your end of life product and looking at, you know, circular economy and closed loop objectives, it's literally not going to be linear, but also, you know, it's going to be a very challenging journey. So I think, you know, you have to get those small wins first so that you can have the long-term adoption, and make sure that, you know, when we are trying to tackle the longer term, the higher up fruits, right, that commitment's already there. So when the going up gets tough, we don't give up.
Thanks for sharing. And also a big part is what we are doing today, and what we shared before in terms of storytelling, in terms of sharing this case studies, in terms of bringing this conversation at the forefront, because more people talk about it, more people will do it. It becomes embedded in our culture more and more, and eventually just a fabric. I'm very hopeful that this will become a fabric of our daily behavior at some point. Overall, all over the world. It is already happening. There's already signs, and I was very optimistic when I saw that, for example, in Italy, they put sustainability in the curriculum for all schools. It's a must-have subject to study in all the schools in Italy. My daughter at her school has projects around how do you recycle, how do you save energy, how do you eat healthy and healthy, not necessarily from a health perspective, but also from a carbon footprint perspective. So I think education, we're seeing a lot of things being done in a good way there, and hopefully more and more as time goes by and as quickly as possible, hopefully. So I want to end on this positive note that things are moving in the right direction, but also by encouraging, like you both also said, people to, I mean, we need to start with ourselves, right? We need to be the change that we want to see in the world, and to share it with others, and to continue to have these conversations. And I'm pretty sure that companies will do more and more. And of course, it's also the good part with all these discussions that it becomes a very important and must have brand activity, like we rightfully shared, that in order to attract the employees, you need to have this element, which is crucial for people nowadays, that the company does things in the right way, which is another big plus. So on that note, I wanted to thank you all for the time. Thank you for the sharing. Thank you for the case studies. And hopefully in the next months and years to come, we'll see even more noise, more improvement, more big data for MIT to analyze, Alexis, and to share with us on how sustainability is growing and booming.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me also. The key is to act. Act now and spread awareness, guys.
Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.